Previously on Anatomy of Next.
The moon is not a destination, it's a direction.
Mars is 40 million miles away.
Are human beings creators or destroyers?
It is a desert, utterly dead world.
Now you belong to Mars.
The alternative is to become a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species.
I'm on Mars.
Is anyone there? Over.
But it doesn't have to be. We looked at every aspect of turning Mars into an habitable world. From a frozen, rust-red desert rock in space to a warm planet with an atmosphere and free-flowing liquid water, streams, lakes, an entire ocean. Now we're picking our story up on a blue planet, which is incredible, but we still need to figure out how to feed ourselves. We have to learn how to farm on an alien world, and before we can even get to that, we need dirt. That means today we are dipping into eco-hacking, and we're creating a brand new entire alien biome. From taking a look at how plant life ticks to transplanting ecological culture samples from Earth, genetically modifying crops, and redesigning from the atom up our biological world. Let's build the Martian forest and fields and make a blue planet green. I'm Mike Solana, and this is Anatomy of Next. New world.
It's a hugely complex interaction.
There could be really awesome genes out there.
How could you create a completely stripped down, simplified ecosystem that would support basic life on Mars?
I was at a biohacking conference back in September, and a guy there was working on a project in the, well, I don't know if you could call it a whole technology space, really. He was genetically modifying trees to fight back against urbanization, which, in my opinion, is a polite word for people. He called the project Ents, as in the sentient trees that wrecked Saruman in Lord of the Rings, and I was, of course, immediately obsessed, because, first of all, it's just this sort of self-evidently insane and amazing application of our tools in synthetic biology, but also a genetic boost to plant life, to make plants more durable, to make them need less and produce more. That is directly applicable to what we're doing on Mars. Remember, our goal is not just to explore Mars. This has never been a strict science mission. High level, we're trying to expand the human frontier and to preserve the phenomenon of life by extending its reach into the universe. This means life on Mars has to be able to sustain itself. For colonists, we can't bring in the food we need. The cost of that, at least barring some incredible advance in technology, is totally prohibitive. And for organisms less complex than humans, so the crops we'll need to feed ourselves, we can't rely on chemical fertilizer from our home world. Either everything our colonists need to live comes from Mars, or humanity, and by extension, all known life, will eventually end on Earth. Picking up after our Martian thunderstorms, we've got liquid water now. We've got light, and we built an atmosphere, so we have plenty of protection from radiation. Now what about food? And before we get to genetic engineering, let's take it from the ground floor. What do we actually need, physically and chemically, to grow plants?
Right. Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they said
this was the problem I think most famously tackled and only fairly recently by Andy Weir in his book The Martian.
I gotta figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist.
This is a little clip from the movie. We see Matt Damon kind of working the sands of Mars into tillable soil, but in the book, Weir really captures the problem at hand, and he writes, Martian soil has the basic building blocks needed for plant growth, but there's a lot of stuff going on in Earth soil that Mars soil doesn't have, even when it's placed in an Earth atmosphere and given plenty of water. Bacterial activity, certain nutrients provided by animal life, etc. None of that is happening on Mars.
I'm Simon Gilroy. I'm a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Professor Gilroy works on research related to plant stress biology, and he's particularly interested in what happens in space because, I mean, really, what's more stressful than that? We're a long way from the Fertile Crescent, but if we're going to grow plants on Mars, we got to make soil. And here's kind of a weird question. What is dirt? Dirt is the stuff that it seems like plants need dirt. We're trying to, I think, make dirt on Mars. What is dirt?
So on Earth, dirt is minerals from rocks weathered. But in addition, there's a lot of organic material. it's the detritus left over by biology. And it's the combination of those two. If you want to have a really good growing soil, it's got a lot of organic material in it, because that's part of what plants have evolved to deal with. A lot of it is sort of the body of biology. So bacteria, plants, and animals. So we're talking about things like carbohydrates, proteins, breakdown products, amino acids, you know, everything that used to be alive on the planet is not alive anymore, but the remnants of it are around. It's this awesome recycling system of, think of a tree and it grows, and then the tree dies and it falls over and it rots. And the reason it's rotting is the interaction with the microbes that are breaking it down. That turns it into the constituent bits that built that tree to start with. And those are recycled by the rest of biology.
So on Mars, we have carbon dioxide. We have ample water at this point. We have the right atmospheric pressure. You know, we have light. It seems like one of the things we're going to need that we don't have is nitrogen. And on Earth, that nitrogen is basically, I believe, fixed by bacteria in the soil. Is that right?
And so nitrogen is one of the big three. You know, if you buy plant fertilizer, it'll have three numbers on it. It'll be something like 10, 10, 10. And those are the ratios of three of the really important macronutrients, things you need in large amounts: nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, NPK. And so nitrogen is a big one. Nitrogen is a major limitation to a lot of plant growth. It comes from the action of biology. So a huge proportion of the nitrogen in the Earth's soils comes from the action of bacteria. It's the decaying remains of other pieces of biology like plants and animals. And then there's nitrogen that is geologic in origin, so things like nitrates. But the biggie is biology. Biology is our source of nitrogen.
Is the only reason that we need the bacteria in our soil the nitrogen, or do these things offer other benefits that I'm not?
No, it's a hugely complex interaction. So there are nitrogen fixing bacteria, which are part of that whole nutritional side of things. But, you know, just like for humans, our guts are packed with microbes, and the interaction between that microbiome and our biology just does a huge amount of different aspects of how we work. So there are microbes which are related to getting nitrogen. There are other microbes which are related to getting other mineral nutrients. And there's a fungal interactions with plant roots, which nearly every plant on the planet uses fungi to help it work its way through the soil. There are bacteria that live inside the plants that are important for how plants work. There are bacteria on the surface of the plants which modulate sort of defense and help it interact with the environment at the level of, are things going to attack it or not? It's hugely complicated.
It seems, I mean, am I wrong in thinking that before we can just grow something there, we need to seed it with sort of like fungus and bacteria? And how do you go about doing something like that? What is the strategy there?
So you can grow plants under perfectly sterile conditions, right? So the bacteria and the fungi are not 100% required to make the plants work. But if we want to make them work as well as they do sort of outdoors on Earth, then we're going to need to replicate that complicated biome. It's a very complicated set of microorganisms that live in the soil. Your guess is as good as mine about how we would seed that area with those kinds of microbial communities.
Dr. Gilroy might have actually said it himself a little earlier in our conversation. Just like for humans, he said, our guts are packed with microbes, and the interaction between that microbiome and our biology affects a lot of what we are. All right, so this got me thinking. Building a planet's biome, I mean, this is an enormous question. It's almost totally abstracted from us. So what if, in trying to glean answers on seeding our new world with life and building that biome, we took a few steps back and looked at something we understand a little better, the microbiome that lives inside us?
I think that a relatively underdeveloped discipline that is interesting on Earth and would be essential for doing this on Mars is synthetic ecology.
Dr. Michael Fishback is an associate professor and chemist, microbiologist, and geneticist out of Stanford. He works on the human microbiome, and his mission is to re-engineer it. A parallel between global ecology and human ecology is already something he's thought a lot about. If the bacteria in our stomach affects the rest of our body, if gut health, in a sense, is health generally, one would naturally want to optimize that bacterial ecosystem. One may even want to engineer it. And if you can do that on the scale of a person with, say, something as simple as a fecal matter transplant, could you do it with a planet? I drove down to Palo Alto and asked Dr. Fishback about his work.
We're building the gut microbiome from scratch. It normally consists of hundreds of bacterial species. One might estimate 600 to 800 different bacterial species would be found in a typical human gut. And we're trying to construct something that's perhaps not quite that complex, but is 100 to 200 bacterial species completely defined, mixed together, and transplanting it into first an animal and then a human gut to reconstitute that ecosystem.
So back to the task at hand. How do we relate this all to Mars?
I just spoke with Dr. Simon Gilroy, and we'd gotten up to the point where, you know, we're on Mars, we have an atmosphere, we have water, and we have all of the macronutrients necessary to grow life, but the surface of the planet is totally sterile. Is there a parallel here? Am I crazy? I mean, can you just maybe take a piece of the sort of Earth microbiome and bring it to Mars and let it go?
Let me try to take it in a few different ways or stepwise as the case may be. I'll give you a silly example from the kind of work we do to help you explain why I'm taking a somewhat contrarian view of the answer to your question. Often, as an experimental system, in order to test what effects an engineered microbiome has on a mouse, we'll use mice that have been bred to have no bacteria at all. These are called germ-free mice. They live in a bubble. They look like mice that you and I see running around our houses if we're unfortunate. They're not completely normal, but they're normal enough to resemble a regular mouse, but they've got no bacteria at all. We can then transplant one bacterium, or in the case of the experiments that are ongoing in the project that I described to you, a complete bacterial ecosystem into the gut of the mouse, and it takes right away and begins functioning normally. The intestine of a germ-free mouse is very much at the stage that you describe Mars to be when I'm entering the conversation of how we get from here to there. It has the raw materials that it needs to support the growth of bacteria, but there's no bacteria there. Let me contrast that to the way that a gut community normally develops. There's a process by which that ecosystem comes to be, and it takes place over the first 3 to 4 years of human life. And kids like my kids did when they were that age will come into contact with food and surfaces and other things that manage to get into their mouths that will piece by piece and through a somewhat chaotic process that's not completely understood, lead to the development of a community that takes 3 to 4 years to come to look like the one that currently exists in your gut or in mine. By contrast, when we colonize the gut of a germ-free mouse with a fecal sample from another mouse or a human or something that's a synthetic community that has been built in my lab, we cut that process short by 3 or 4 years because we can do it in one day. We put it in, it engrafts, and so it is. I'm predisposed to think that even though normal ecosystems take a long time to come to be, it doesn't have to be that way.
So you're saying it is totally practical, it's totally reasonable that you could really just take a sample of the bacterium and fungus that may exist in a healthy soil sample on Earth. You could bring it to Mars, it would take.
It's completely reasonable to think, especially if you gave me the intermediate step of knowing what the conditions are like on Mars and helping to put some of the keystone organisms through a little bit of evolution on planet Earth, evolution that's directed towards optimized growth under what are perhaps slightly different ambient CO2 and mineral conditions than you would find, or temperature conditions. And all of these are things that there's been a lot of experimentation, directed evolution in labs on planet Earth, showing that you can, on laboratory timescales, make it possible for organisms to optimize their growth to different ambient conditions. So I view all of those things, creating a set of keystone organisms to support a microbial ecosystem, as being solvable with modern engineering.
I think that a relatively underdeveloped discipline that is interesting on Earth and would be essential for doing this on Mars is synthetic ecology. In the same way that people who do synthetic biology have done a great job of expanding the scope of how you engineer life, and also in challenging views of what can and can't exist and that is living on planet Earth, synthetic ecology is a good way, will be a good way to understand how ecosystems actually work, because I think you don't really understand something until you build it. And in challenging us to think about how could we create something, not to replicate what we have on planet Earth from Mars, but how could you create a completely stripped down, simplified ecosystem that would support basic life on Mars?
But the question itself, engineering our environment is, in a lot of circles, like almost radioactive. There are people who just don't want us messing with, and I'm using air quotes here, the natural world.
This is sort of almost maybe a little bit of philosophical pushback. There are all these people who believe biological systems are too complex, to engineer from scratch. We like to think that we can do these things, but actually we end up causing more harm than good. I don't, what do you say to people like that who say that we can't engineer something this complex? You're playing God and you're messing with things you don't understand. And
right. I respectfully disagree categorically with that point of view. Whenever a new problem emerges, an easy and I think intellectually sloppy response to seeing its complexity is to say it's so complicated, we'll never understand it or be able to build it from scratch. This is something that is difficult to disagree with at an early point in time because nobody's done it and because things can seem irreducibly complex when you look at anything. A Martian could show up here and look at an airplane and say, this thing is irreducibly complex and we'll never be able to understand how it works. But of course, we know that there's an airplane is something that we've built, so it is understandable and you can take it apart into individual pieces and get it. And I think that this is a philosophical point. One could still argue that even a simple bacterial cell is so complex that we don't understand in any depth how it works. We have a parts list and we understand things that happen when you remove or add one part at a time, but we really don't get it in the way that you understand what happens when you turn the key in a Mustang. You understand every event that happens along the chain from turning the key to the engine starting up and exhaust coming out of the tailpipe. I'd argue that we will come to understand cells and organisms in exactly that way and ecosystems and be able to build them from scratch. They're not made of an infinite number of parts. And I'd argue that it's a fragile point of view to be arguing that there's no way to reconstruct something complex because one can probably capture most of the salient features without getting to the very last component. And that kind of thing can happen quickly.
Now, I know you guys are probably ready to get to the part where we talk about designing trees capable of taking over the world in synthetic biology, making our plants more durable by actually engineering them to be so. But there is just one last glitch to consider before we get to all that. On Mars, we may need to take a look at removing a few things before we start adding them. Earlier in this episode, we talked to Dr. Gilroy, and he left me with a warning.
On turning to Mars, you know, we have, I mean, the last I checked, it seems like we have every single macronutrient that we need. Some quantities of those macronutrients are a little bit dicey. For example, nitrogen is going to be a bit of a problem, not one that is insurmountable, but a bit of a problem. What am I missing? You know, we have sunlight, we have carbon dioxide, we have water, we have the macronutrients.
So we're on good ground with Mars. If you look at chemically, everything that we need is there. I think, for all of that nutrient side of how plants operate. Some of the biggest problems with Martian soils are, you know, Mars used to have a lot of water in it, and there's a lot of some things like evaporation and stuff that's gone on. And if you just put your mind into what the Earth would look like if we evaporated all the water off the surface of it, the oceans are packed with salt, and that all gets concentrated down. That's kind of one way to think about what the surface of Mars is like. So it's very salt, and plants are not that great with high salt. So high levels of salt somehow would have to be dealt with. And then also because of the chemistry that goes on Mars and because of the atmosphere is not like the Earth's atmosphere, there's quite high levels of a group of compounds called perchlorates. And the perchlorates, you don't find those on Earth in very many places. You find them kind of in two places. So rocket fuel, so they're pretty good rocket fuel, and also the constituents of weed killer.
The Martian perchlorate issue has come up in a handful of my recent interviews. In high enough quantities, perchlorates aren't just toxic to plants, they're toxic to humans. And at least at first, in the very beginning of our colonization, it's gonna be everywhere. In the dust, blowing around, getting into everything. The good news is we can use perchlorates as a fuel source if we can figure out a good way to mine them, and the dust issue should gradually decrease as we terraform the planet and introduce our atmosphere and so a little more pressure and water. Then, at least in patches, our army, remember that army of semi-autonomous terraforming robots, can use the now fairly abundant water on the planet to wash the chemicals out of the soil once it settles, gather them up in higher concentrations, and put them to better use elsewhere. For example, fueling our vehicles or powering our cities. Remember, in the early history of our new world, we want that global warming. It is going to be cold out there, and every little bit helps. But honestly, managing the perchlorate issue is likely to be a long process, and we don't know exactly the best approach here. It's hard to figure out, of course, because we don't even really know how bad this problem is just yet. We gotta get there first and explore. But it's certainly looking like we'll have to protect ourselves and our plant life in man-made or robot-made structures at the early end of colonization. Then longer term, are there any biological workarounds? What I'm asking here is, could we redesign ourselves, our own bodies, to better handle the chemical? We're gonna get to this and more on the topic of biological self-determination, or choosing what we get to be biologically ourselves, in our next episode. For now, we're seeding the Martian soil with bacterial and fungal samples of biomes very specifically tweaked from back on Earth. Now, on top of our dirt here, so to speak, we're facing our first problem.
So nitrogen is a biggie, and nitrogen is a major limitation to a lot of plant growth.
We've brought up nitrogen a handful of times this season because it's one of the things that critics of our Martian ambitions really love to bring up, and they're not wrong. We need nitrogen, and we're not getting that nitrogen from our Martian atmosphere. Now, there are nitrates in the soil, and with a bit of tweaking, it looks like our plants can make use of them. But will there be enough? This whole conversation brings us to the very edge of the basics, to the end of the stuff that just works and the kind of farming humanity inherited from generations past. It's a kind of farming that, with the exception of the introduction of fertilizer, really hasn't changed much these last few thousand years. But today on Earth, increasingly, we aren't just growing plants. We're redesigning them. And in some cases, fundamentally.
ENCE stands for Engineered Tree Systems, and it's about developing robust, hopefully complete ecosystems for the purpose of afforestation, the act of putting a forest where there wasn't a forest before.
So what it sounds like is you are genetically modifying trees to fight back against people.
Yeah, that's kind of where the joke comes from. Fight back is such a strong terminology. What it really comes down to is just that, like, humans are very human-centric. You know, I've got a buddy who's trying to cure herpes. The thing I always end up saying is it doesn't matter if you cure herpes if you can't breathe the air.
Gabriel Lysina is a biologist and founder of SciHouse, a small nonprofit running community education outreach and research in synthetic biology. So I met him at a biohacking conference out in Oakland. And if this is something you're interested in, biohacking, the community, the ethos, the purpose and promise of it all, you can learn a little more about it in our very next supplemental episode, where we'll be sharing a much larger excerpt of my chat with Gabriel. But for the purpose of this conversation, I want to stick a little closer to our immediate task at hand. Designing plants capable of thriving on a hostile alien world. This means we need to look at, broadly, the topic of making plants do what they don't naturally want to do. Gabriel is a kind of activist. He thinks humans have harmed the planet, and his chosen cause with ENCE is fixing that. Now, this might seem a little bit tangential to the questions we're facing on Mars, but on that question of designing our new crops, it was in talking to Gabriel about his work that I first started to get a sense of what we can do on Mars. So we're going to start here on Earth with Gabriel's efforts, then we'll build to the principles behind it, and finally towards a working strategy for feeding our colonists.
So let's get into your work. I want to talk about what you're doing with ENCE. What is the problem as you see it? And then what are you working on right now that you think is going to help this problem?
The problem as I see it is we have dramatically reduced the biomass that works for sequestering carbon and cleaning our air. The bigger problem is we don't actually have a good grasp about how to fix that. When you talk to somebody who's like, oh, hey, we're just going to plant a bunch of avocado trees and those are going to start sequestering the carbon. If those trees don't live for 100 years, it doesn't count. The ENCE project is about afforestation, as I said, which is about putting a forest where there are no forests. And so it works with two sweet hacks. So it's a two-part system. One is a planting method called the Miyawaki method. There was actually a paper that just came out. People were like, oh, when you densely plant a variety of species, you get more carbon sequestration, the plants grow faster. And it's like, yeah, that's the Miyawaki method. It's been around since like the mid-60s. And this is something that everybody has used as a baseline. You can grow trees that'll get up to 3 meters tall over the course of 6 months. That's awesome. And that's just with changing how we plant the plants. Step two is to take genetic engineering techniques that were pioneered by the lumber and sugarcane industry, because they're all about getting that yield, and marry that with the Miyawaki method to grow plants that grow twice as fast, twice as large. These genetic modifications, for as far as we can tell, affect everything with a cell wall. So that's like the entire plant kingdom. Go out, find yourself a forest, look around, be like, okay, I got ferns, I've got moss, I've got like 16 types of trees. I've got this weird vine that looks like it came out of a Disney comic book, and the mod should work on every single one of those. It doesn't just have to be sugarcane. We can take this a step further and use it for bigger and better things.
I've interviewed a bunch of folks who've talked about genetic engineering, and I know a lot of this stuff has sounded like, well, you just cut this or that out, add a little bit of this, and there you've got it. A new plant, a cure to some disease, a dragon. Arthur C. Clarke famously said, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." People share that quote today as if to say something like, "Wow, technology is amazing." That quote has always kind of scared me, because what Clarke is saying is we don't actually understand this stuff. This relates directly to bio, in which, for example, yeah, we can do some really cool stuff, but how much of that do we actually understand?
When we're studying biology, we just knock pieces out, and that's usually how we figure out what a gene does. So we'll like break a gene, and then the aspen tree is all floppy, and we're like, oh, that's the gene that makes it stand up straight. All right, put a little note there. We'll break another gene, and the tree grows in a corkscrew. Real thing. We're like, oh, well, that's the gene that makes it not be all weird. It's corkscrew gene. All right. And so you just do that with a bunch of plants. You get all these weird plants. A lot of them don't even live. And you're like, well, evidently it's very important for something. I have no idea what, because the plant never lived.
So this is it. This is our search process in biology. Now, if a little crude, you can at least be assured we aren't walking through fantasy land right now. We are learning what genes do, and this is the first critical piece of our Martian adaptation engine. So let's get into that. You're talking about making trees more durable, it sounds like. They grow faster, and maybe they're stronger, they're bigger. I'm trying to take this to Mars now, and we need to do this broadly to all sorts of crops, and they need to be able to withstand different temperatures. And there's this perchlorate issue. There's like a toxin all over the planet that, that we have to worry about. You know, how would you...
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because the space kids always just avoid that.
No one wants to talk about it. No one wants to talk about the perchlorate. We're bringing life to a new world. How do you start thinking about that? How do you make plants durable for a new world?
Are we going blue sky here? I have infinite cash. I can do whatever I want.
You can do whatever you want, and I need plants that can grow on Mars. They have enough atmospheric pressure for people to walk around outside, no oxygen, not a lot of nitrogen, and there's this perchlorate issue.
Okay. Step one, there's this really cool art project called the Titan Fly. So they took a Drosophila fruit flies and they started raising them in this chamber that they had made that simulated the environment of Titan, like strong magnetic fields. They kept reducing the atmosphere. They kept pumping in methane and a bunch of other stuff like that. And they would just grow these flies until they basically speciated. And it's like you've got this cosmonaut fly that is capable of dealing with like ridiculous magnetic fields, extra high methane levels, very low oxygen levels.
As Gabriel and I talked, the shape of Martian gene discovery, what a project like that would look like, slowly came into focus. Simulate Mars. Perchlorate rich with low atmospheric pressure, low oxygen, and low nitrogen just to start, and begin growing plants or trying to in that alien environment, which you'd gradually introduce over successive generations of the prototype crop. Nature takes its course. The plants will speciate. We will discover new genes. And then, in addition to the very cool curly tree gene, we'll have genes that help plants manage perchlorates or low nitrogen or low gravity.
That process is called directed evolution.
Mm-hmm. I read about it, actually, speaking of Titan, in The Sirens of Titan by Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, there you go.
So we probably won't be experimenting with redwoods right away. And remember, we don't have to. As Gabriel noted while talking about his work with ants, the bit of gene discovery we've already managed in sugarcane and tobacco, for example, works throughout basically the entire plant kingdom. So what we want to do is experiment on something with a relatively quick life cycle, probably something very small.
Everyone loves to talk about macro species. They're like, yeah, you plant a bunch of trees or some moss and does this. And it's like fungus and bacteria are the primary proponents for making an environment. The trees are basically a front end. We're big, so we look at big things and we're like, oh, that's important. But fungus and bacteria are really where it's at. And it's great because bacteria and fungus have this really high reproduction rate. If you try to go macro, you're going to get caught in a bottleneck because
right, it's too slow.
Exactly.
It sounds like more important than genetic engineering is just increasing the speed with which we're able to experiment on tons of shit.
Absolutely. And you're going to get people that think computers are the way to do that. And that's all well and good. But we don't actually understand how biology works. So it's very, very difficult to do like a working computer model of how a biological system works. It means wet work. It means getting our hands dirty, you know, running a lot of these things in tandem.
I've kind of suspected for a while that the problem in biology is not a cutting problem. People are so excited about cutting, but it seems to be a search problem. We don't know what anything does.
Yeah. So this is like, if anything, I think the takeaway from all of this and something that people really need to hear more than ever is it's not about making products. Because if you try to make like your perfect whatever, you'll find a way to do it. It just won't necessarily be of any sort of value in the long run. If you're just trying to make a product, you're not really learning about how things work. You just end up making that thing. Whereas like when you're doing pure research, just like I'm just going to knock out a bunch of genes and find out what all these genes do. Because like even with Arabidopsis, which is like the core model organism for plants, we still don't know what all those genes do. And so, you know, we break them. We break some, we sequence it, we find out where the gene was, and we're like, wow, this thing has big leaves. Or, you know, whatever. Since we don't understand how these things work, it really is important for us to go in without a question, not searching for a specific thing, not hunting. This is like one of the cores of the scientific method is that you can have a hypothesis, but you're not hunting for the answer. When you develop your protocol, you're trying to develop something that tries to prove it wrong, not something that tries to prove it right. So you're right. Going out, experimenting, exploring, breaking things, making things is going to teach us a lot about how these things work. And since we don't know mostly how these things work, there could be really awesome genes out there that are going to do what we want way better than the stuff we have now. Or we're going to find something where we're like, we should totally get rid of that because that's going to cause a problem. But we don't know. You know, we need to remember that and act like we don't know instead of being like, oh, I'm just going to make myself space tomato.
This is the process. It's science, not necessarily technology. But on that technological application, there has been some interesting work. Nitrogen is our big boogeyman, but it's actually an issue here on Earth as well. This is something we've been working on for a long time. I sat down with my colleague, Alex Silverman, and we talked a bit about some of the work we've seen done on this issue. All right, so we've been talking a lot about gene discovery and different ways that we can find genes that work to make our plants more efficient in all of these different ways. But the one that is really important, comes up again and again and again, as we talked about many times this episode, this season really, is nitrogen. And this is actually something that we have worked on. Alex and I were just speaking about it.
Yeah, we went deep into the plant nerdery. This is something that we've actually been researching since the mid-1990s. Our first successful genetic tweak of a plant to process nitrogen more efficiently was in 1995, and there have been several big studies and a lot of different projects since then. Our engineers tried to boost enzymes to help plants uptake nitrogen more efficiently. In the early 2000s, 2004, one really interesting project added a gene that is naturally expressed in corn plants to a different variety of plant that helped those plants attach and store nitrogen more efficiently. It was a really promising result. One of the most recent research projects I read about when I was looking into this was out of Washington State, and this was just last year in 2017. Researchers there genetically engineered pea plants to overexpress an amino acid. Nitrogen is transported via amino acids, so it just helped plants internally transport nitrogen more efficiently, which also helped these plants grow and yield more.
People are not generally thinking about ways to apply this to Mars, right? I mean, that's pretty much just us on this podcast. But the idea of us just needing more nitrogen for our plants, at this point, we know it. We can't actually feed our whole entire population without use of fertilizer. And you were mentioning that like fertilizer is this huge problem.
Yeah. So nitrogen's the principal component of fertilizer. We're using this fertilizer to expand our crop yields, but also what that does, it has some negative environmental impacts. It contaminates our drinking water. It pollutes our coastal seas. Microbes process nitrogen in soil and produce greenhouse gas that's 300 times the effects of CO2. Plants are actually really poor at uptaking nitrogen. So we're spreading all of this fertilizer all around the globe, but plants are only uptaking about 50% of it. There's a lot of waste there.
So what it sounds like is there is massive incentive to fix this problem. We're learning more maybe nothing is working exactly as we want it to yet, but we've been doing it for a few decades now. We're getting better and better at it. Now we have new tools, increasingly more discovery. It seems reasonable to think that this really is going to be the approach for us on Mars. We're going to be designing crops that use less nitrogen.
I read a lot of optimism from these researchers. Like you said, the incentive's there, the tools are getting better, we're learning more and more. They want this to happen, and I think it will. They're working hard at it, and there's a lot of not just goodwill, but actual money that's being put toward this now.
Biology, the cell, is the original nanotechnology. The nanotechnology, in the words of George Church, that we've actually got working. Little green self-replicating robots that want to thrive. From 1 to 2, from 2 to 20 trillion, starting in greenhouses along the coast and slowly bringing life outside our habitats as the planet warms and that atmosphere thickens, humanity will watch in awe as a once red planet, now blue, turns green. From desert plains to farmland and forests, Mars is not just wet now, it's alive. Next, we have a couple supplemental episodes coming your way, and then New World Episode 7. We've designed biological systems on Mars to be more like Earth, so that our species can thrive on an alien world. But what if, instead of changing the Martian environment, we changed ourselves, genetically? Sit tight, we're about to get a little controversial. I'm Mike Solana, and this is Anatomy of Next. New World.